rabbit with a black eye crying about the epidemic of child abuse. And then there's a drop out of nowhere. Their separation also led me back to therapy, something I had frequented as a preteen and now figured couldn't hurt. Since childhood, I had wrestled with what would later be diagnosed as obsessive thoughts disorder, a condition where negative visions repeat in my head to a point where it's impossible to function on an everyday basis. It started as constantly seeing the tombstones of my still-living grandparents when trying to fall asleep at 11 years old, and hasn't really let up since. Sounds super chill, right? The disorder had taken a backseat during the Hot Carl excitement, but the divorce, which was the most painful experience of my life up until that point, reminded me exactly how rough I could be on myself. OTD is harder to control during times of stress or pain, since the floodgates of self-doubt are then opened and my brain basically becomes a Woody Allen monologue. But my mom and dad's decision to uncouple came way before I developed methods of coping with OTD, and I couldn't avoid constant thoughts of both my parents breaking down and dying alone. I would be lucky to get 3 or 4 uninterrupted hours of sleep or 30 minutes a day without an obsessive run of thoughts. Depressing thoughts like, "Your dad is unemployed and always alone," would constantly replay in my head, which made writing funny lyrics like, "Yo, you don't want no bad blood between us like we're standing right next to Magic Johnson's inner Venus," quite a contrast in my life. It's not like I wanted to be the next Maya Angelou, but the cognitive dissonance I was now experiencing was immense. No matter how hard I tried to remove myself from my parents' rough patch, their situation was the only thing I could think about. Making matters worse, someone at Interscope had secretly leaked me a few songs from Eminem's 3rd album, The Eminem Show, during his recording process, thinking it would help me understand what direction he was going in. Instead, it threw me deeper into a hole of anxiety. I heard Cleaning Out My Closet and My Dad's Gone Crazy, both still in demo form, but both also absolutely brilliant and surefire signs he wasn't going anywhere but up. Eminem was getting significantly better, and I couldn't get out of my head. But almost like the music industry had its own version of antidepressants, right when things got unpleasant, more money found its way into my bank account, allowing me to stifle any real feelings of discomfort for the time being. When people talk about the record industry nowadays, the conversation is usually dominated by talk of the financial struggles that musicians, even successful ones, have to endure. Since the transition to the digital era, their only regular income comes from touring, merchandising, and corporate endorsements / sponsorships, leaving record sales, and to an extent publishing, rather disappointing for the wallet. Selling out is no longer a term. We're living in a climate where Bob Dylan's I Want You was used in a Chobani yogurt commercial and nobody gave a shit. So imagine how difficult it is for an emerging musician to live comfortably while building a name and fan base in 2016. But in 2001, the fury to sign new artists was still in full effect. So when I got a call from a prominent publishing company, it couldn't have come at a better time. An executive at the company had been tipped off by some Interscope employees that Jimmy was poised to make Hot Carl the next Eminem, so he wanted to make an offer on the copyright of my words before a bidding war happened down the road. So in simpler terms, they would become a partner in managing my lyrics and intellectual property in situations where they could be used in media. They joined my team, collecting royalties on my behalf, and actively searching for films, TV projects, and yogurt commercials to license my music for. The catch here was that, in return for this partnership, they'd need to pay me a large advance against possible future earnings, creating a bit of a dice roll in case I never actually recoup that upfront payment. The publishing company would be betting my advance against my ability to eventually pay it back, and then start making them profits. So you really only had two options as publisher. One, you sign a tremendous success story who quickly repays the upfront loan and makes you look like a psychic. Or two, you throw a shit ton of money into a fire. It's these kind of odds that might make it a little easier to understand why the music industry has been in a steady financial decline over the past 20 years. Adding fuel to the fire, another publishing company reached out after Timbaland brought up my name in a meeting as someone he'd be working with soon. I now had two large conglomerates jockeying to give me ungodly amounts of cash with a bet that even Pete Rose would say was too risky. When the dust cleared, I had signed a publishing deal worth $500,000. It would be broken up into two payments, $250,000 upon signing and $250,000 with the release of my major label debut. And I didn't have to record anything new or even lift a finger to fulfill the agreement. Keep in mind, no Hot Carl album, or even a single for that matter, had a set release date. But they were willing to make that bet. Who was I to say no? I had read enough depressing Motown biographies to know that giving away your publishing was an easy way to find yourself eventually living in an abandoned car wash, but I also knew that the opportunity to earn that kind of guaranteed money could not be ignored. After I asked my lawyer, Fred, the same question maybe 15 times, He assured me that a publishing company, just like a record label, has never gone after an artist who didn't recoup their initial advance. As long as the musician didn't act like a real asshole and change their name and move to Mexico the day after they got the check. Feeling safe, I quickly signed the paperwork they sent me, hoping to get it to them before they changed their minds, and planned to pick up my check from Fred's office during my upcoming New York trip. However, before my trip to become USC's richest recent undergrad, I wanted to finish a new song I had been working on called The Burbs, a track where only a few years out of high school, I chronicled the most disturbing parts of growing up among spoiled classmates in the San Fernando Valley. In early versions, I included my own experiences in the lyrics, like mentioning the varsity point guard who secretly videotaped unsuspecting girls during sex, or the honor roll students who implemented complex cheating systems just to keep their grades impressive. As the song got more attention at the label, I got less specific about my high school issues and tried to relate to frustrations that all lower to middle class kids might have had when comparing themselves to peers born with silver spoons in their mouths. Looking back, it's the song that makes me cringe the most, purely because it reeks of white privilege and whining. I make myself feel better about it by acknowledging that I was the first to address this specific suburban angst through rap, something regularly addressed by 2016 MCs with names like Hoodie Allen, Little Dicky, and Mac Miller. And in truth, whether The Burbs worked or it didn't, I always tried my hardest to deliver the song's lyrics in a tongue-in-cheek manner, joking during live shows that the track sampled the world's smallest violin. The Burbs included lines like, "From the outside, they pretend it's sweet home, where little 8-year-old kids have their own cell phones. And if girls have problems, daddy buys them bigger breasts, like every answer to the test is resting in your daughter's chest." As I was recording the song, I would regularly hear the term second single from DJ, meaning we could follow up a more humorous pop debut with something a little deeper and emotionally revealing. The plan was to get a special feature from a well-known singer for the hook, since what I had written for the chorus had the feel of a big rock ballad. The label immediately suggested Fred Durst, which theoretically felt right and would only strengthen my standing within Interscope. I'd be using one of its own stars. Despite our rocky history, Fred expressed interest after hearing the track and finding out that he could make a whopping $50,000 for the appearance. So we quickly booked a mutually agreed upon studio time for him to record. As is the case with almost everything described as mutually agreed upon, one of the parties didn't show up, and once again I was on the receiving end of Fred Durst's true douchebaggery. He would later explain that he'd lost track of time, and now wasn't sure he was a good fit for the song anyway. I didn't allow his fickleness or erratic behavior to affect me this time, however, and decided to dust myself off and just find someone else. Since I was still working with Sugar Ray's DJ Homicide on a few tracks, he suggested that the lead singer of his band, Mark McGrath, take a shot. I had never really been a fan of Sugar Ray per se, and even if I were, I wouldn't admit that in a book that will last forever. Despite this fact, I saw how his inclusion on a song about the suburbs made perfect sense, since most of his success was surrounded and validated by those exact white people I was rapping about. I agreed with Homicide's opinion, giving me the chance to now write a sentence so based in the 2000s that I might as well post it on my MySpace. I had a song with Mark McGrath. Mark became famous for a reason. His impeccable singing. No, I'm fucking with you. He can't sing. He's famous because he's insanely likable and the first to admit his strengths and weaknesses. When the time came to record vocals for The Burbs, he made sure none of us were in the studio when he sang his parts because, as he put it, then you'd find out I can't carry a tune. He always knew, and still knows, his role in pop music, employing a self-effacing approach that makes it nearly impossible to hate the guy. In the end, no matter who he recorded in front of, Mark sounded great on the record, even if the background vocals, once just a reference track sung by the producer, were still loud enough to be the leads. And when we finished the song, he sent me a very pleasant message via two-way pager, suggesting I leave space on my mantle for a Grammy. I knew he was bullshitting me. And if Hot Carl had won a Grammy, I'd obviously make a joke here about how Nas has never taken one home. Nonetheless, it's obvious that Mark McGrath, in another life, would have made a great politician. A few weeks later, still high off our collaboration, Mark texted me after finding out that my birthday was coming up. He asked what my plans were for the big night, and I answered him with the truth. I'm having pizza with my divorcing parents. Mark, realizing that I'd somehow found a way to make pizza sad, informed me that he had reservations for a table at Las Palmas, the city's most exclusive nightclub at the time, and would love for me to join him. He planned on turning this birthday into something I'd never forget. I accepted the gesture and braced myself for another strange Hot Carl experience. It's difficult to remember the details of a night so clouded by alcohol that one falls asleep in the bushes outside his friend's house, but I'll try my hardest. Even to this day, I'm not much of a drinker, so when Mark kept ordering bottles of Cristal for our table, and I kept drinking direct from them like I was Damon Dash on a yacht in an old Jay-Z video, I shouldn't have been surprised when I blacked out. I do remember sitting in a booth next to Hugh Hefner and an accompanying group of 15 playmates, only to eventually do the running man for one centerfold, who I would later kiss because Mark told us to. I also remember telling one of the members of Crazy Town, inexplicably named Squirrel, about my parents' divorce, then escaping to the bathroom to cry in a locked stall. And I remember eventually getting kicked out of the club for falling asleep in someone else's booth. Okay, I don't actually remember that. It's what people told me the next day. The last thing I vaguely recall is getting in a taxi, only to wake up in a planter holding an empty bottle of Cristal close to my face like a baby with a security blanket. I somehow managed to make it back to my place, nap all day, and still attend that night's pizza party with my splitting parents, which at times was more painful than the hangover. On my way to hang out with my mom and dad, I finally heard from Mark via text. I was excited to recall what we did the night before, but more important, to get filled in on what I didn't remember. I was about to tell him about waking up next to azaleas when he easily one-upped me. He revealed that he woke up with a Virgin Mary tattoo on his neck and didn't remember getting it. He seemed genuinely shocked by this discovery, especially the immense size of the body art, considering he wasn't religious. He admitted he'd somehow still had a great night, but was never drinking again. I went on to thank him for the birthday hospitality. He jokingly told me to pray for him. He had the tattoo removed shortly thereafter. A few weeks later, in the middle of the night, Mark paged, inviting me to come hang out with him and Jay Gordon, the lead singer of Orgy, as they built a battle bot. I asked if he was kidding, and he responded in feverish detail about the remote-controlled machine's arsenal of weapons and precision. I began to think maybe he wasn't serious about the never drinking again thing. I politely declined his invitation, never finding out if that night also ended at a tattoo parlor. But honestly, I've never had another birthday as exciting as the one Mark McGrath threw me when I was almost famous and turning 21. Finally of legal drinking age, I checked into my New York hotel, drank a celebratory beer, and arranged to stop by Fred Davis's office to pick up the first half of my publishing payment. In the year since I had signed with Interscope, I had realized that most of the money from that outlandish deal would go toward my production budget. This newfound wealth from publishing, on the other hand, would go directly into my pocket. I walked the 10 blocks to his building, almost skipping the entire way, assuming there'd be fanfare at the office, like a photo opportunity of me holding a gigantic novelty check like it was the state lottery. I walked into Fred's lavish Manhattan office and braced myself for noisemakers. Slightly more calmly than I expected, I informed the receptionist that I was Hot Carl, here to see Fred Davis. She looked up from her computer, gave me an irritated look, and mumbled something about me being early. I apologized and coyly admitted I was excited. But before I even finished my sentence, she handed me an envelope that had the name Carl with a C written across the front. I was surprised by the quickness of our interaction and lack of balloons or blaring horns, so I sort of just stood there, waiting for her to congratulate me or bring out a cake. She looked up, annoyed, and asked if that was all I needed. When I inquired about seeing Fred, she informed me he'd be in meetings all day, but sent his best. I said thank you and walked out as she jumped onto a new phone call, which I could only assume was Ja Rule calling to wish Fred a Merry Christmas. I sat in the lobby staring at the misspelled envelope. Maybe the celebration I had hoped for was non-existent, but seeing my name attached to a check with that many zeros was unbelievable. I'd been given a rap career in the same way John Goodman was given royalty in King Ralph. I kept thinking someone was going to abruptly show up at one of my recording sessions, tell me it was all a misunderstanding, and ask me for the money back. But instead, all I ever heard was that I was the next big thing and one of the most talented up-and-coming MCs in the game, and people were just throwing money at me. With nearly $1 million invested in my rap career, I was in the Big Apple now, the birthplace of hip-hop, ready to meet and work with a whole new set of producers and rappers in an attempt to round out my album and get it primed for release. The label promised to connect me with some of the hottest names in the industry while I was in New York, and I was ready to take full advantage of those resources. Among them was a new producer named Kanye West, who had just begun his roller coaster ride toward fame. At the same time, mine was getting closer and closer to the free fall drop that would eventually define my career forever.
The Burbs, Lyrics, 2000-2001, 20 and 21 years old.
I went back and forth about including these lyrics in the book, mostly because the song hasn't aged well. And truthfully, never sounded the exact way I had imagined. It's by far the most embarrassing song from the Hot Carl library, since without any context it feels very corny and reeks of the dated 2000s teen aggression that dominated the charts. But I'll say this. Movies like American Beauty and Alpha Dog, which is also inspired by a true story from my high school, would visit similar subjects soon thereafter, and that white kid angst became the cornerstone for most of pop punk. So maybe the lyrics were just ahead of their time. Or maybe this song just sucks and I'm making excuses.
I was raised in a suburb that was hardly healthy. Grew up in the middle of the most affluent and wealthy. 'Cause most people assume happiness within the burbs. But please hear my words, that lifestyle is absurd. Remember Clueless? See, that's my hood, but more ruthless. The method on how they call it depends on your wallet. From the outside, they pretend it's sweet home, where little 8-year-old kids have their own cell phones.
This is sort of the norm now, right?
It's the burbs where money's the only need, 'cause millionaires survive on principles of lust and greed. See, we talk about a place where middle class is second rate, ridiculed at an early age for not having a guarded gate. And in this case, parents try to buy their kids' love. How do you think most of these kids can afford all of these drugs? But we sit back and act like it's the best place on earth, without admitting the worst shit happens right in our suburbs. When you're on top of the world, it's lonely. When you have everything, it's empty. And the ones you call friends are your enemies. But that's the way that it goes when you live in the burbs. The burbs. The burbs. The burbs. Where it looks like a dream, but it's never how it seems. It's so sick my high school was like a fashion show, a runway for expensive clothes and cash flow. At such a vital age, puberty can't run its course. Kids are dissed for looking different and 'cause they can't play sports. No surprise when we'd come back from Christmas break to see most of the girls' noses molded into pretty shapes.
No matter what I think of the song now, I still really like this line.
And if girls have problems, daddy buys them bigger breasts. Like every answer to the test is resting in your daughter's chest. There's so much plastic surgery, people look obscene, girls following images that can't humanly be achieved. It's a vicious cycle, reality is distorted. Why do you think all these girls develop eating disorders? 'Cause girls who weigh more get called ugly and fat. And we expect these kids to keep level-headed through all that. Yeah, we look happy, but what's it all worth? 'Cause you lose your identity living in suburbs. When you're on top of the world, it's lonely. When you have everything, it's empty. And the ones that you call friends are your enemies. But that's the way that it goes when you live in the burbs. The burbs. The burbs. The burbs. It's all about the salary and nothing about reality. I'm sure there's places like this wherever you call home. Same fucked up suburb just with a different zip code. Where spoiled brats live in a fake reality. Where the student parking lot has better cars than the faculty's. And the sickest shit, the richer, the quicker they are to fight. Despite all of this cash, they live like it's thug life. With a bunch of racist kids trying to be tougher than the next, it's like they're obsessed with American History X. But in due time, these problems will show. Why do you think these high school shootings don't happen in ghettos? So next time you see a student driving a Porsche, throwing cash like Jermaine Dupri, living like Brandon Walsh, imagine their classmate who ain't got shit, can't find his place in Utopia, although he's supposed to live in it. And getting picked on for years eventually hurts. But then again, it's just another day up in these suburbs, huh? When you're on top of the world, it's lonely. When you have everything, it's empty. And the ones you call friends are your enemies. But that's the way that it goes when you live in the burbs. The burbs, the burbs, the burbs. The all-American dream isn't exactly how it seems. Look closer.
Once a year, someone still tells me about how much this song meant to him or her in high school, and that always feels weird. The song was heavily downloaded on file-sharing sites like Napster and allegedly ended up quoted by some kid in a manifesto in which he threatened to shoot up his school. Truthfully, that tainted the song forever, and I haven't been able to listen to it since. Chapter 16. Kanye West owes me $300. The day after I became the most unlikely 100,000-er in hip-hop, I began working at Baseline, a now-defunct multi-room studio where, at the time, Jay-Z was recording The Blueprint next door. No matter what time of day it was, you could see any of the biggest rappers in the world working or just walking room to room to say hello. Baseline would be the epicenter of Rockefeller Records in its heyday, the birthplace of most of the label's biggest hits. Hove, Beanie Siegel, Young Guns, and Freeway all recorded songs there, and I like to think I was the only white rapper to have done the same, a theory I dreamed up after Memphis Bleek once asked me for a soda in the kitchen area, assuming I was a studio intern. I regularly joke that my recording sessions there look like the opposite of Hootie and the Blowfish. I first heard of Kanye West, an eventual Baseline frequenter, through beats given to me by my manager at the time. In anticipation of my first New York City trip, he passed me the snippet CD that read in Sharpie, K. West, hoping we could find someone new and cheap to include in our itinerary. Kanye was being touted as an emerging producer and had yet to really take off since recently moving from Chicago, but I was told that a handful of rappers were currently writing to his stuff. Also, two of Rockefeller's main consigliaries managed him, so I assumed he was at least producing a few songs for the dudes who held Jay-Z's weed. At this point in rap history, the beat CD was the industry standard vehicle for producers to introduce their work to rappers. Think of it as a business card of sorts. Producers would submit instrumentals to labels, managers, and artists in hopes of getting rappers to flow on their music and getting a check for the release. I had heard every beat CD making the rounds at the time, and everything started to sound alike. All I kept doing was bugging the label to connect me with Just Blaze. It was nearly impossible to avoid a Just Blaze track when listening to urban radio in the early 2000s, and his rise to dominance is important to note when discussing Kanye's origins. Just Blaze's signature sped-up, chipmunk-sounding soul samples are an essential part of the era's legacy, and I was a huge fan. So when my team told me I was being directed toward Kanye, who shared a manager with Just Blaze, instead of my pick, I insisted that we just keep bugging them for their top dog. I felt cheated, like I had asked a DJ to play a Michael Jackson song, and he instead played Alien Ant Farm's cover of Smooth Criminal. Eventually, Interscope informed me that Just was too busy to take on new work, and I was told something that, for better or worse, would stick with Kanye for the first year of his production career. When you can't afford Just Blaze, you get Kanye West. This theory was echoed by their shared management and somewhat validated by Kanye's similar dependence on soul and pitched-up samples. For as unique as Kanye West has become, his origins lack the inventiveness he now displays on every new release. When I became friends with Just Blaze years later, I told him about this anecdote and he shrugged it off with class, explaining everyone starts somewhere and that he had never heard the saying about Kanye before. For the record, I think he's being a nice guy and knows exactly what I'm talking about. But even though he had a reputation as a plan B, I wanted to give this K. West CD a listen. After only a few seconds of the first song, I called my manager and told him to set up a time for Kanye and me to chat. After listening to the rest of his music, I fell in love with a later instrumental track that sampled Laura Nyro's Woman's Blues, and I knew it would work perfectly on my album. Jay-Z would later turn that first beat I heard into Izzo, H-O-V-A, so I sleep better at night knowing that even though I had the chance to make that Jackson 5 sample my own, Sean Carter did more with it than I ever could have. On the resulting conference call with our managers, Kanye was polite and accommodating, excited to be making what would be, at the time, the most money he'd ever made from music. Somewhere between $5,000 and $7,500. But that all took a quick turn when he heard which track I selected. The vision and stubborn determination we're now accustomed to seeing from Kanye suddenly cropped up out of nowhere. "But that's the one I made for Ghostface," Kanye explained. One of his managers, G, reminded him that Ghostface had heard it in past. "Yeah, but I gotta talk to him. Pick another one." I said excitedly, "Oh, you know Ghostface?" Even after my personal experience with RZA, I still wasn't cool enough to hide my enthusiasm whenever Wu-Tang was mentioned. "No," Kanye said abruptly. G quickly changed the subject, knowing they had a bird in the hand from Hot Carl and that Ghostface had no intention of working with Kanye. We compromised by agreeing that I would write to the beat, and if Ghostface were to change his mind in the next 2 weeks, we'd pick another one and go from there. But no matter the resolution, Kanye didn't say another word to me for the rest of the phone call. I was never late for a session. I was raised with a strong work ethic, and while I'd sometimes have to wait 5 or 6 hours for a rapper to arrive or to get stood up by Fred Durst, I treated this job like it involved the government. So when I got to Baseline Studios for my first day with Kanye, a few minutes before our session was supposed to begin, I was surprised to see him already at work. I was also pretty taken aback by what K. West looked like. The swagger you see in the megastar now was entirely absent. His Aniche tracksuit jacket and baggy pants were about two sizes bigger than anything a rapper would wear, even in 2001. He was sporting an outfit that a 50-year-old woman in a wardrobe department would put together if a rapper was mentioned in your script. We were more than a decade away from rappers mentioning Tom Ford and Marc Jacobs in songs, or from Kanye debuting his own weirdo high-end clothing line during Fashion Week, but the guy just looked plain goofy. And the gold chains and Jesus piece that would eventually appear around his neck were replaced by the only bling he had at the time, adult braces. I vividly remember saying, "This guy looks like Bowfinger," to my manager, who would whisper "Urkel" in my ear over and over. Coincidentally, Kay West seemed just as shocked to see what H. Carl looked like, and not just because I wasn't Ghostface Killa. He took one look at my vintage rock shirt and ripped jeans and seemed instantly relieved. While most rappers would have just assumed I was there to play bass on the song, he found my appearance comforting. "Aw, man, I would have dressed like myself. I do this for rappers," Kanye explained, pointing to his outfit, which was so baggy it could have doubled as a Jesse Pinkman Halloween costume. And on our second day of recording, he transformed just like he promised. The future icon ditched his Juggalo-esque threads for a Jim Morrison t-shirt and rock-inspired jeans. Don't get me wrong, though, he still looked nerdy as fuck. And in turn, Kanye was treated like the ugly stepchild of Baseline Studios. He was too eager and too dorky, lacking the restraint and tough guy persona that ruled rap music, and more specifically, New York City for decades. When he heard me rhyme the Carlito-inspired line, "Me and Kanye made this real picante and grande, why you suck as actor Mondasante," on our song together, he visibly displayed excitement, saying no one outside of his friends had said his name on a track yet. Traditionally, he would have pretended he didn't even hear it, trying not to look so fervent. He talked too fast and altogether too much, a tendency we now know is something he can't change as fast as his wardrobe. On that first day of recording, we found ourselves alone in the room together, and that's when he let me in on a secret. "You know I rhyme too," Kanye nervously divulged, making sure no one else heard him. I was caught off guard. No one had even mentioned that he was more than a producer. Not even in passing was he called a rapper. "I'm actually keeping a lot of the best beats for my own shit," Kanye said confidently, seeming to forget I just paid something like $7,000 for a beat he didn't think was his best shit. "I'm just doing this to rap." But the way Kanye said it, that first time we met, it felt like he was telling me something he wasn't supposed to share, something someone constantly reminded him not to bring up in sessions. I'd learned quickly that no one at Baseline considered Kanye a rapper. They'd get annoyed whenever he'd talk about it. Even his managers rolled their eyes when he mentioned his rap career. Everyone knew he was a talented producer, with only that one complaint that he sounded like an affordable Just Blaze. But popular opinion was that he didn't have the skill or look to take the stage himself. I remember one day while recording, Kanye played an early version of Jesus Walks, several years before its release, to a room that included myself, some A&Rs, some assorted industry types, DJ Clue, rapper Fabulous, and engineer Duro. As the song played, Kanye acted out and mouthed his lyrics, something he always did while his own music played, and I assume still does. He acted as if a music video was always being filmed around him, displaying yet another example of the unaware enthusiasm and egotism that would make him the butt of almost every joke at Baseline. The song ended, some people shared some positive but subdued comments, and Kanye left for the kitchen. A few seconds passed before the entire room erupted in laughter. A few people even mocked him, mimicking his rap voice and making fun of his over-the-top zeal. One major producer in the room even asked his assistant to make sure Kanye never performed like that again. Lucky for him, he didn't have to, because 3 years later, Jesus Walks would win a Grammy for Best Rap Song. No joke here, he deserved it. Let's be straight, though. I, too, was a hater, and just as guilty of underestimating Kanye, when in reality, I should have understood being underestimated more than any rapper in the game. You see, when I first met Redman, who I recorded a track with on this trip and paid way too much for, we sat and talked for 20 minutes about what would become of our joint effort. I played him the track with my raps already recorded onto it and smiled ear to ear when I saw him bobbing his head along to my words. We threw around ideas for his part and talked about his philosophy on writing lyrics. About an hour into the session, after I thought we had a real creative connection, he politely asked when I thought the rapper would arrive. Confused, I told him I was the rapper. I was also the guy he had been collaborating with for the past hour and the dude paying him to be on the song. He admitted that he thought I was just the studio assistant, leading me to wonder just how much musical credit Redman is giving studio assistants. Right then, I promised myself I would only feature rappers who were actually my friends. For example, I wanted to have an underground remix of the Redman song featuring up-and-coming MCs like myself, not just dudes we paid $15,000 to pretend they were my friends. So I asked my pal Mr. Eon from the High and Mighty to participate, and Redman suggested slash demanded that we use his buddy Icarus. I obliged, because at least he's someone's friend. I called Kanye to see if he wanted to hang out at Baseline that day, and he showed up early once again. At some point during the day, Kanye asked my manager if he could also jump on the remix, and I still kick myself to this day about my response. Now, in my defense, my opinion about his rapping ability at the time was shared by most of us around him. And people who hear his early demos still agree. He just wasn't very good. He sounded like a crappy Mace and was so breathy that sometimes I couldn't even understand his punchlines. I remember he played me one new track over the phone where he used only movie titles as lyrics. I could understand maybe five of them tops. He sounded more excited by what he was saying than any listener would be. So when my manager asked what I thought about adding him to the remix, I laughed. I told him to say it was already too long and suggested that he could be one of the many voices that yelled the hook. So if you're keeping score at home, I said no to Kanye West rapping, but yes to two rappers you've never heard of, and paid another to mistake me for a studio employee, just so a soon-to-be rap superstar could be one of the seven voices yelling one word during the hook, which he is. Also, why are you keeping score of a book? After recording our song, Kanye would come to LA frequently to record with rappers and meet with labels about his own career. I would hear behind-the-scenes talk that labels like Interscope, Capitol, and Atlantic were also unimpressed with his rapping aspirations, but were eager to work with him as a producer, so they'd take the meeting. One radio DJ I knew called me to tell me that one of my friends from New York had visited their weekly station meeting, played his song Unbearably Loud, and jumped on the conference table to sing along. He didn't have to tell me who it was. I knew. Kanye started to get buzz for his continuous work with Jay-Z and Beanie Siegel and was developing an R&B guy, who also worked with will.i.am, named John Legend. Since we kept in touch, we would also try to hang out during his visits to the West Coast. We weirdly saw the movie Master and Commander together, which Kanye loved and I fell asleep during. We went to Las Palmas together, where he would pay DJ AM $50 to scratch the part of Guess Who's Back where Jay-Z said his name. And one of our meals together was at the Mel's Drive-In off Hollywood Boulevard. Funny enough, I would stand outside that exact Mel's location as Kanye's face was projected on its side wall to debut a new song in 2013. I paid for that lunch, and that wasn't the only time I paid for something Kanye needed, a concept that now makes me laugh harder than a bunch of rap dudes at Baseline hearing Jesus Walks for the first time. After one of our late recording sessions, I wanted to finish up the song and knew we had about an hour left of work. Kanye was living with his mother in New Jersey, feverishly working on beats and secretly lyrics at the time, a period of his life he commonly talks about to this day. He didn't own a car and would take the train into the city whenever he worked, which is impressive when you take into consideration that he was also always early. He said he wanted to keep working that night, but in an hour he'd miss the last train home. I assured him not to worry, as I could easily just call a car service. He explained how far and expensive that would be, but since I thought the song was really coming together and I actually liked hanging out with Kanye, I let him know I'd pick up the bill. He insisted that if I did, he would need to pay me back one day. I said sure, not really paying attention, but he repeated himself numerous times, making me promise I'd actually take his money. The car cost me a little under $300, so it wouldn't break the bank, but I assured him I'd have no problem taking it back. For the next year or so, he reminded me via two-way pager about this loan a few times, making sure I never forgot about it. Somewhat kidding, but mostly serious. I never really cared about the money, but since he was making a big deal out of it, I started to keep track. For his recent Yeezus tour, I spent about $300 on mid-level seats. He never paid me back. I don't miss the irony. After our song together, the team around me continued to work with Kanye. My manager actually did believe in his rap career and unsuccessfully tried to get him signed to a major label. Weirdly, Kanye had always seen Rockefeller as his backup plan, since he knew that his managers could pull a favor and get him a deal if everyone else passed. In the end, everyone did pass, and he obviously signed to The Rock, despite hearing at the time that even they didn't really want him. Around that same time, an Interscope A&R hired him to work on a rock hybrid act he was developing, which was actually the session Kanye had just left when he got into the car crash that would spark it all: his rap career, his presence in the fashion industry, and his decision to run for president. Quite a chain of events. At this point, I doubt he still loves that piece of shit Russell Crowe ship movie. Kanye and I would talk consistently when we were both carving out what would be or wouldn't be our rap careers. We conversed mostly over pager, where he would frequently ask me what to rent when he was at Blockbuster. I would suggest a movie I figured he had never seen, and he'd immediately pick it up. So if he ever says Ghost World is his favorite movie, I can finally say I see my influence in his work. and in what can only be seen now as psychic ability, or just plain insanity. His signature for every message sent through his two-way listed the title of each album he planned on releasing over the next decade in order. He didn't even have a record deal yet. Weirder? He actually followed this checklist perfectly until 808s and Heartbreak, leaving Good Ass Job as the only unused album title on the list, but picking up a slew of awards and acclaim for the ones he chose and announced before his managers would even acknowledge he was a rapper. Did I see the egomaniacal madness behind his nerdy, unassuming exterior? Absolutely. He'd randomly ask waitresses taking his order if they wanted to hear him rap. When they'd say no, he'd just spit the verse anyway. Even after being advised not to, he forced himself onto the red carpet at Jay-Z's bowling birthday party, where he was kind enough to make me his plus one, so he could throw up the rock sign for the first time for photographers. He was annoying, but he knew what he wanted, and looking back now, I don't think he was going to stop until he got where he is today. We talked briefly while he was in the hospital after the crash. I joked that having his mouth wired shut and not being able to rap for strangers seemed like his personal twilight zone, and I don't remember if he laughed. But I do remember he had the last laugh, because he made a hit song in that condition. We had a few light conversations right after Through the Wire hit LA radio, but after that we lost touch completely. You can easily say that I failed and Kanye blew up and that he ditched me because of that. But the truth is, I never really gave him the opportunity to ignore me. I was thrilled for him, but didn't really know what to say as he became rap's biggest sensation. I was so excited to see this passionate friend, someone I had seen ridiculed and undervalued, achieve his dreams. But I also knew he was headed for the type of universe where he could rant about leather jogging pants for 2 hours. For the record, he also simply became a better rapper. He doesn't sound like he just ran a marathon anymore. I would have put all my money against the little dweeb in braces and his attempt to make it big rapping. He showed me, and everyone else around him, that he was a mad genius. When I say that I was no longer in touch with Kanye West after 2002, that doesn't mean we haven't seen each other since then. In 2009, I helped out 88 Keys, another rapper/producer I maintained a friendship with way past my days as Hot Carl, with a music video. 88 Keys was also a close friend of Kanye's, and at the time doubled as an advisor of sorts during his meteoric rise to the top. Since then, 88 Keys has found himself with production credits on two of Kanye's most critically acclaimed albums, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy and Yeezus. But back then, he was releasing his own solo project on an indie label. He secured Kanye to be the album's executive producer and to rap on the first single, Stay Up, Viagra. 88 Keys reached out to me, hoping I could convince my friend Pete Wentz from Fall Out Boy to appear in the music video they were scheduled to shoot in LA. Pete was a big fan of 88 and obviously of Kanye, so it wasn't hard to make the connection. The next thing you know, without much information at all, we were told to meet the crew on Hollywood Boulevard at 4 p.m. When we arrived, we didn't see 88 Keys or Kanye mouthing the words to the songs, but rather two old black men arm in arm with two scantily clad video vixens looking like they just escaped a retirement home. We realized quickly that they were actually Kanye and 88 Keys in disguise, bad grandpa style, causing havoc on one of LA's trashiest blocks. Oddly enough, they stayed completely in character to cast and crew, even when the camera stopped rolling, which is just the right type of crazy for Kanye West. Besides us, there wasn't a person in Los Angeles who knew the true identity behind Kanye's elderly disguise. If they did, he'd have been swarmed. Pete filmed his cameo, which took place in a sex shop, quickly as the whole video was being shot without permits. As Pete rapped, both old man 88 Keys and old man Kanye walked up to say goodbye to us. Both, still deep in method acting, complained about back pain and endlessly thanked Pete for hanging out with two old geezers like us. Kanye kept joking, almost like he was a community college improv student, talking endlessly in an excited and ancient tone until his eyes met mine. At that moment, he stopped talking immediately. He may have remembered the months of convincing me he was going to be the biggest rapper in the world while still living in his mother's house. Or maybe he heard those rappers and producers laughing behind his back when he left the room at Baseline. He might have recalled the nights at LA clubs, when no girl would talk to him or believe he produced for Jay-Z, or the baggy Aniche sweatshirt, or the braces. He may have even remembered the remix I wouldn't let him rap on. Or maybe he didn't recognize me at all. Either way, he abruptly stopped riffing, turned, and walked outside. He disappeared into a car and was immediately on his way to the next location. As we watched the car drive away, an intrigued girl who worked at the sex shop asked, "So who is that guy anyway?" I turned to her and said, "I don't know anymore, but he owes me $300.
Armand Asante, Lyrics, 2000-2001. 20 and 21 years old.
One night, while recording at Baseline, I'd eaten dinner with Kanye at the nearby Pan-Asian restaurant Ruby Foods, still located in the heart of Times Square. I had fearlessly eaten sushi and paid for it later with explosive diarrhea that interrupted our session numerous times. I contemplated calling our song "To Ruby Foos, Thanks for the Poisoning," but DJ convinced me not to. I instead picked my mom's favorite character actor and made sure to include his name randomly in the lyrics.
The game's on. Hot Carl dominates your ears. I'm making suckers disappear like a meal's career. I'm just joking, but you having trouble coping. 'Cause you beating me is like Def Leppard's drummer jump roping. 'Cause me and Kanye made this real picante and grande, while you suckers act Armand Asante, suburban strangler, able to rip a stranger, with lyrics so hard I'd even make mystical say danger. And right here's an MC that you should fear, underground like snuff films, throwing bows like Leyenbeer, crushing the rest till there ain't nobody left. And if I don't go double platinum, then I'm blaming Wyclef.
This is a very specific joke for very specific hip-hop nerds about a battle rapper named Cannabis who blamed his album's dismal response on his mentor Wyclef Jean. If you were one of the 7 specific people who got it, we should be friends.
So rhyme for rhyme, line for line, let's get it done. None other will do when my crew is out there having fun. Punchlines like landmines, Bensonhurst to Anaheim. I'm dropping dimes while y'all suckers silent like pantomime. What? Don't let me run off at the mouth. I'm always into something, got everybody running. It's my year, dog. Warn Tyrese that I'm coming. Fucking up the scene, take away your self-esteem. The Jewish Jay-Z, call me William Hollerstein. I keep attacking and send your crew packing. Nobody's feeling you like Kobe Bryant rapping. So keep on yapping, it's obvious you hate me. Real racy, expose myself like I was Casey. Now I'm bringing new views to the table, able to bring in more kids than Jermaine Dupri's label. Take you out and watch you flow come to an end, able to go 3 the hard way without Puffy's friends. Changed the game before one song was finished. Spent so much cash made Farm Club go out of business. You ain't touching the Baldwins at all.
People always ask me if I had a crew. M had D12, Nelly had the St. Lunatics, so I made one up just so I didn't feel left out. We called ourselves the Baldwin Brothers, and it was a posse consisting of myself, Maddie, and 2 incredible rappers I grew up near, Abnormal and Ryu. I have many regrets for my time as Hot Carl, but very few as genuine as wishing I could see rap fans wearing merch that said, "The Baldwin Brothers."
It's a family, dog. Drink babies and suck balls. Like what? Don't let me run off at the mouth. Can't wait until I'm platinum and drowning in wealth, so I can talk about my cash and sound like everyone else. Wrecking this, more infectious than asbestos. Making heads bob up and down like motherfucking Pez dispensers. I'll take your wig and part it in the middle, 'cause any one of your mizzles ain't fucking with hot kizzle. And for that shizzle, obvious and of course dangerous like sporting ice to the next Source Awards. The shit I kick is on a unique level, and we call up Rebel when we got some fights that we want settled. Beating 'em till they can't hear like Halle Berry. You try hard but still fuck up like Daryl Strawberry. Rip you apart, so baby don't start. Driving down Mulholland in a Hummer go-kart. This is lyric shit, tough shit, never soft. HotCarl.com, log on, fuck off.
Chapter 17, Going Ham. After finishing my session with Kanye, I stayed in New York City for another week recording a DJ Clue-produced song with Fabolous, who had just released his first single, Can't Deny It. Before that song blew up, my manager and I randomly met the lyricist standing in line at a Popeyes, which is where all great rap songs should come together. We kept in touch with him, and next thing you know, right when his career was taking off, he became another big name to officially appear on a Hot Carl song. As was the case with every new development regarding my project, there was no negotiation or pushback from Interscope when they found out Fabolous wanted somewhere near $15,000. costs still never seemed to be an issue. During my time in the industry, musicians were still recording together in the same studio, rather than just emailing parts back and forth, which is now the most common practice in hip-hop. During our session, Fabulous was an incredibly humble and delightful guy. After hearing what I had written for the track, he seemed surprised by how much he enjoyed it, which also caught me off guard, since I had included an obscure Simpsons reference. "Just point him out and I'm down to go get him, because most rappers say stupider lines than Ralph Wiggum," a shout-out I didn't expect much praise for. But Fabulous kindly admitted he dug it, an uncommon disclosure from one competitive MC to another, and decided to throw out the lyrics he'd brought to the studio in order to match my intensity. I took his willingness to start over as a compliment and a sign of respect, even when he included a subliminal diss to me in his new bars. When he rapped, "I'm constant hated, listen to the nonsense stated, but rappers can't shit on me like they're constipated," I definitely understood he was talking about me and that I'd never have to explain to him what a hot Carl was. Not everyone was as quick to catch on to the true meaning of my moniker, though. A majority of people I met during the years I was signed to Interscope called me Carl, as if it were my birth name. And most actually believed it was. Some probably still do. Even my hype man Maddie called me Carl until only a few years ago, and I was in his wedding. My mom always seemed offended by people's tendency to use the nickname offstage, something that rarely happens now, mostly because she'd worked so hard to find a unique name like Jensen that would stand out. And I had also happened to adopt one of the most popular German names of all time, which, for a different reason, offended my Jewish father. I always loved learning who did and didn't know what the other meaning of my professional handle was. I remember Jimmy Iovine being confused and somewhat grossed out when I finally had to tell him that the origin involved feces. On the other end of the spectrum, one night in 2001, I was introduced to Christina Aguilera. Her assistant at the time was dating an avid Hot Carl fan and had played her my music. So in the middle of a crowded nightclub, the assistant decided to make sure I met Christina, secretly hoping we would make music together. Christina was just about to reshape her image, ditching her initial bubblegum pop persona for more provocative songs like Dirty, which had a music video that you could basically catch HPV from watching. The music in the club that night seemed louder than usual, so Christina's assistant had to yell our intros. "This is Christina!" the assistant screamed as I reached out to shake her hand. Christina smiled politely. "This is Hot Carl!" the assistant followed up, leaning in and yelling to reach Christina's ears. "Wait, Hot Carl? Your name is Hot Carl?" a surprised Christina yelled even louder, unable to tell if we were joking. I nodded yes. Her assistant, who believed my real name was Carl and that I had added the hot just to brag about how good I was at rapping, seemed confused. Christina howled with laughter, unable to keep her composure. She was like an audience member at Def Comedy Jam in the 90s, jumping and cackling down the aisles after a Martin Lawrence punchline. She tried to mutter "nice to meet you," but struggled as she caught her breath in between laughs. As awkward as the exchange was, I walked away happy to assume that Christina Aguilera knew the slang term for shitting on someone's chest. UrbanDictionary.com lists the definition of hot Carl as the act of leaving feces on your partner's stomach, chest, or mouth area while engaging in sexual activity. But to this day, the site also includes an alternate definition, a rapper from the San Fernando Valley. It's not necessarily the legacy I expected to leave behind, but I'll take what I can get. With the Fabulous song now in the can and positive feedback from my East Coast encounters, I was picking up a good deal of momentum and getting more and more industry attention. Another heavyweight who became interested in Hot Carl was Steve Schnurr, an executive hired by EA Sports to curate music in their popular sports games like Madden NFL and FIFA Soccer as part of an initiative called EA Tracks. He had reached out to my management, hoping to tap me for a song to include in the newest installment of my favorite game series, NBA Live. I jumped at the opportunity even before I knew the game would feature every musician as a hidden character in the game, a benefit so cool that I envisioned it being inscribed on my tombstone. They digitally scanned my face and took my measurements, using the data to create an unlockable player by typing California into a menu screen. The producers picked that code after I asked them to please use Jewish and was ignored. To announce EA Tracks, I was summoned to a posh hotel near my house where I'd meet with press and talk about my excitement. My enthusiasm escalated when I found out that the other rappers who would be heard and seen in the game included Just Blaze, Fat Joe, Snoop Dogg, Joe Budden, and one of my favorite rappers of all time, Busta Rhymes. Most of the other participants were stationed in New York, so I was their only sure bet to attend, until they got word that Busta would also be in town for the event. I wasn't expecting much from my entrance into the hotel room that now doubled as an EA media hub, considering I was the least famous of the bunch, but there seemed to be something stealing the employees' attention as I walked in unnoticed. There was an overall sense of urgency everywhere I turned, with a dozen or so people in EA shirts whispering to each other and unsuccessfully trying to hide the outright panic on their faces. And then out of nowhere, a man barged into the room and yelled, "Remove all the ham! Every piece of ham!" With that, everyone scurried to different corners of the space, removing pieces of ham from platters that were scattered throughout for snacking. Everyone moved at an almost comical speed, searching high and low for slices of deli meat like a businessman 15 minutes late for a meeting trying to find his car keys. The concerned EA supervisor looked at his watch and sternly said, "He will be here soon, and I need to make sure there are no pieces of ham anywhere in the vicinity for Busta Rhymes." I had no idea what was happening, but I couldn't have been more intrigued. Then, as if I had just seen something I wasn't supposed to see, someone grabbed me by the arm and hurried me into another room, where three men, introduced to me as the game's producers, were stationed around computers. I was shaken up, confused by the last few seconds of pandemonium, and depressed that I'd never get to see what happens when Busta Rhymes is around ham. It consumed my thoughts until the programmer started asking for details about my in-game custom baller, and then my attention went straight back to the video game. I asked that my digital representation wear jersey number 88, the year Straight Outta Compton was released, protective goggles, and vintage John Stockton short shorts, all demands that were respected and seen in the final product. They also inquired about my skills rating, a way gamers could choose the ballers they wanted to play with, on a scale of 1 to 100, calculated by averaging out scores assigned to players based on attributes like speed, ability to dribble, and field goal percentage. This ranking decided how well you played in the game. For example, Shaquille O'Neal playing in his prime back in early 2000s was a 92, making him an unstoppable force and someone you looked forward to dominating with. The developers explained that as a celebrity edition, I could pick any rating I wanted. They revealed that the other rappers selected numbers in the 90s, with DJ Clue picking 92 and Baltimore rapper B. Rich, being slightly less modest, selecting a 99. As they got ready to jot down my rating, I had a bit of a dilemma. My entire rap career had been based on authenticity. I never wanted to represent something I wasn't, and based on my hardly impressive freshman basketball stat line of 3.6 points per game, I knew I wasn't a 99. I thought it over and said confidently, 75. The producers looked at me in disbelief. They made me repeat my answer again, reminding me that I could pick any number I wanted and that people would decide whether or not to play with me based on this ranking. I was like a boy who found a genie in a lamp, and when asked for his first wish, he said, a haircut. But I was positive I wanted to stick with 75, understanding that if I were to be graded as a basketball player, I'd actually be thrilled with a steady C. And just like that, I was the lowest rated celebrity player in NBA Live, on par with other mid-level athletes like Brent Berry, Keith Van Horn, and Robert Horry. When the game was released, my mediocrity was painfully obvious, especially for kids who excitedly stumbled upon the code to unlock me, only to realize that I was a glorified bench warmer. Being included in NBA Live was an accomplishment I still consider one of the coolest of my career, especially since they sold over 1 million copies of the game, and in turn, the CD of our music that came with it. Sometimes, still, when people realize I'm Hot Carl, they bring up the NBA Live song immediately, claiming they remember every word from their hours and hours of gameplay. As a basketball fanatic, the ability to rap lines like, "When I throw another dream, it's gonna fall, of course. I'm wearing the goggles that Kurt Rambis used to sport. And you coming up short like Spud Webb gets to walking. I'll pull a Mutombo but let my finger do the talking," meant the world to me. There was no option to create your own soundtrack, so honestly, players' ears were held captive. I too played the game religiously, often online against competition from around the world. I was testing the product in the field, wearing a headset to talk to opponents randomly selected by the server, something I couldn't imagine DJ Clue doing between yelling on mixtapes. My song, a basketball-focused reworking of my track with Fabulous, would frequently play on the game's main menu while you were waiting for an online game to start. During the game's entry screen, not only could you hear my song, but you could also converse with the person you were about to face, a human you only knew by their gamer ID. I had selected my gamer ID around the same time EA Sports contacted me, and at the time, the idea that Hot Carl MC would mean anything to anyone on my PlayStation never really crossed my mind. Even now that I was on the soundtrack, if anyone ever tried to talk to me, I would usually just ignore them, making me question why I even wore the headset in the first place. One day, while listening to my song on the headset, as I waited for a game to start, my opponent, JeffGold12, surprised me by speaking. "Hey man, good luck," he said, hardly audible over my jam, but still clear enough to sound like he was maybe 11 years old. "Thanks," I said meagerly, still weirded out by talking to a stranger I was trying to beat in video game basketball. There was a moment before he spoke again. "Your name is Hot Carl MC, like the rapper in the game. I perked up, excited about the recognition. Yeah, like the rapper, I reiterated with a smile, ready to acknowledge that yes, he was about to play NBA Live with the actual celebrity in the game. But before I could get the words out, he cut me off. That guy's a fucking loser, the preteen announced, with the disdain in his voice to let me know his feelings about my work loud and clear. I sat in embarrassment, no longer wanting to play the upcoming scrimmage. Yeah, he is, I said, then unplugged my PlayStation for the rest of the day. Despite that teen's opinion, EA Sports would hire me again to consult on another basketball game, NBA Street Volume 2. It was the sequel to their popular playground basketball game that rivaled and ended up being more impressive than its competition, NBA Jam. They reached out to me, knowing I was a fan of the series and a diehard EA customer, in the midst of my climb to celebrity. They were to fly me out to Vancouver, where the company's headquarters were located, in order to test an early version of the game and give notes on possible additions and its soundtrack. I was to be joined by Just Blaze, who I would finally connect with, and another up-and-coming rapper who, after a troubled past riddled with a mythical amount of violence, was rumored to be signing a major label deal soon. His name was 50 Cent. After I landed at Vancouver's airport, I ran into 50 Cent and his manager in customs. As a hip-hop nerd, I knew a 50 from his prior attempt at fame, way before he encouraged Shorty on her birthday, with a song called How to Rob. I introduced myself, we shook hands, and they both seemed like pleasant guys. 50 Cent was incredibly charismatic. I remember his smile being infectious, even if it was somewhat mangled by a recent shooting that infamously changed both his career and jawline. We stood patiently in line for permission to enter the country, a feat that proved simple for me once I revealed I was in town to work for Electronic Arts. I was waiting for a car outside, now joined by a representative from the company, when 50 Cent's manager walked up to let us know they wouldn't be able to join us on the ride to the hotel. Assuming he meant they'd lost their luggage or planned on eating at the Tim Hortons in the terminal, I shrugged it off. I figured it wasn't a big deal, until he explained that 50 Cent had actually been deported. After learning that Curtis Jackson, as 50 Cent is known by the government, had been arrested on drug charges at some point in his life, Canadian officials quickly denied his entrance. Not only was he banned from NBA Street, he was banned from literal Canadian streets, too. Bummed, I said goodbye to his manager and got in the car. 50's criminal record works as the perfect excuse, but the government has also since stated they believe his violent content could influence and steer young men into a life of crime and mischief. And as crazy as that sounds, maybe the Mounties were onto something. When 50 Cent was eventually allowed to perform in Canada in 2003, a man was shot and killed outside his concert in Toronto, and similar violence ensued at a Montreal venue after he took the stage. As a result, a member of the country's parliament officially addressed permanently banning 50 Cent forever, making him a hilarious exception to NAFTA. But no matter how intense this immigration-based rivalry became, I can always say I was there the first time Canada treated 50 Cent like a platter of ham in Busta Rhymes' dressing room. As my career progressed, so did my parents' divorce. I was put in the middle of their intense disagreements, pushing my obsessions into an even more unavoidable place. Heartbreakingly, they decided to sell my childhood home and split the money. My mother rented a small house only a few blocks away, while my father, in an attempt to get lost, packed up and moved to Las Vegas. He quickly began self-medicating and acting erratically, rarely leaving the house, yet finding himself in questionable situations that I never saw coming. My mother also fell into a depression, so in between recording sessions, I would try to spend as many nights as I could with her. The worst-case scenario was in full effect. Despite being engulfed in my music, my obsessive thoughts disorder reappeared to focus on my father's unemployment and the worry that my mom would never find someone to take care of her. I wasn't sure how much more I could take. And that's when my father was first diagnosed with lung cancer. He'd been a frequent smoker during many periods of his life, but hadn't relapsed for most of my teenage years. I had assumed that during his pilgrimage to Las Vegas, smoking was one of the many vices he decided to pick back up. But I never thought the damage had already been done. He moved back to Los Angeles for his treatment, and I became a part-time rapper, part-time caregiver. This marked the beginning of the hardest time of my life. While my dad was getting radiation and chemotherapy, I began discussing release schedules with DJ at Interscope, trying my hardest to give my career the attention it needed. Even if I had bigger issues to attend to, everything seemed on pace at Interscope, with the excitement for my album still at a fever pitch. I was still competing in battles when I found time, able to channel humor during a difficult patch, although it came from a much darker place. With lines like, "Remember Corky from Life Goes On? Well, you're way more retarded, so don't get me started." Sure, it's pretty offensive in retrospect, although timid for rap standards, but I was angry, and battling seemed like a safe outlet to let off steam. Meanwhile, Eminem started releasing music from The Eminem Show around the same time. It sold 1.3 million copies in its first week, and he eventually raised that total to over 10 million. His graphic lyrics and hateful content sparked protests and became talking points for political pundits. while critics celebrated the work, which would go on to win a Best Rap Album Grammy, and deserve it. His 2015 win for the Marshall Mathers LP 2, on the other hand. Interscope also announced they were teaming up with producer Brian Grazer to make a film starring Eminem that was loosely based on his life. And it was clear that he was not only the top priority of the label, he was running the building. Any hope that he would just fade away, opening a lane for a similar artist to emerge, had dissipated long ago, leaving me to hope that the audience, as well as the label, would be able to notice the obvious differences in our content. And it seemed like there was precedent, at least in other genres. In pop music, I watched NSYNC surpass their predecessors, the Backstreet Boys, almost perfecting a formula the latter had debuted. There was room for at least two boy bands in that genre, even if you ignored groups like LFO and O-Town, who were both hot garbage. But I wasn't sure the same could be accomplished in hip-hop. I went from being described as a white rapper by almost everyone to being called a rapper like Eminem. It hurt and seemed like unnecessary.